Thanks, Alex, and welcome everyone. As Alex said, I'm Kelly Thorpe with USDA ARS at Maricopa, Arizona, which is just located about 20 miles south of Phoenix here. And I'm going to be speaking today on some of the things that have to be done in order to make data that come off phenomics vehicles useful for analysis down the chain. If some of you have been to our workshops that we've had on phenomics in Maricopa, then this might be review for some of you. There's been a lot of people that have put together the ideas that have led to these kinds of developments in plant phenomics, and I list some of them here. In particular, for this talk, I'd like to point out Matt Conley, who's a tech at our location, and also Allison Thompson, who's a new cotton breeder at our location. They've provided some slides for this talk. So my talk's going to be divided into a bunch of different kind of subsections that all fit into the idea of a workflow for phenomics data. First of all, in terms of platform design, you have to select between different types of vehicles, different types of sensors, and you have to have a data acquisition capability. Field design and layout, this is something that's very important in terms of the analysis of the data due to the volume of it. And coming up with designs and being able to geospatially represent your plot maps is very key in the whole processing pipeline. Data management, large data sets being collected. So how do you represent those, say, in a database? How do you store it and provide access? Processing of the data, including quality control, geoprocessing, removal of outliers, so forth. And finally, I'll touch on data enhancement, I call it, which is the idea that you can combine sensor data with physical models of a system and therefore enhance the data, bring about potentially new phenotypes from that. In terms of vehicle selection, so there's lots of different technologies being explored, and here are some vehicles that we use in our program. This is our Lee Avenger high clearance tractor that we use. We've also done a lot with manual pushing carts that we construct from square tubing and bicycle frames. UAVs are a new thing that we're getting into. Some of you might be familiar also with the LemniTech scanalyzer that's been constructed at the Maricopa Center. And I think this is a KSU vehicle, a robotic vehicle. So I'm going to focus today mostly on how you work with data from ground vehicles. And so I'll focus on data that might come from our Lee Agra Avenger high clearance tractor. There are three core types of sensors that we have on board this machine. Infrared thermometry used for canopy temperature, multispectral sensors in terms of crop circle for canopy reflectance, those are active sensors. Ultrasonic or acoustic sensors that measure distance and can be used to get at plant height. You can see the crop circles mounted on the front of the boom here. The IRTs are here. We have eight of them, and behind them are four sonic sensors. We're using a IMU now in order to get the vehicle heading, and I'll talk later about why the vehicle heading is crucial in terms of how you post-process these data. Our RTK GPS antenna is here, and we're using a National Instruments PXIE data acquisition system that runs the entire sensor package with LabVIEW. Newer technologies that we're exploring include spectroradiometers, imagers, and LIDAR. Okay, in terms of data acquisition, so many different choices for how to log data. I mentioned the PXIE chassis from National Instruments, which we use on our Avenger. Other simpler systems might rely on Campbell Scientific data loggers. And the new thing is these like $35 computers that you can buy, a Raspberry Pi. It's a very inexpensive computer that can be bought, and you can turn that into a data logger on a system. All of these types of systems are going to require programming. So you have to program the loggers in order to collect data from the sensors, and typically the loggers will store the data at some sort of formatted file on a hard drive on the vehicle. So the format of those files are important, particularly for considering how to process the data on down the line. And design of standardized ways to log data for these purposes is an important goal for our community. On to data management. So this is after you would take a vehicle in the field and collect data, then what happens to it? And the whole rest of my talk is going to be on just that piece. Planning is very key in terms of the data management, because the data can overwhelm you. It is often so large in size. It's a fact that you can't measure everything. It's just not practical to measure every detail. But on the other end, it's also a fact that if you don't collect the appropriate data, then you might be lacking something down the chain. So it's an important step at the beginning of these kinds of efforts with research groups to define what data you need in order to achieve your goals at the end of the day, given the constraints. And that might vary. It might be different among different research groups. But efforts to sit down and think about this and plan this will save you at the end of it all. We're using databases now to store our data. There's a lot of advantages to databases there that you can see, but one of the main ones is that it kind of forces your data into a structure that you've pre-designed, that you've pre-planned, and so databases can be a useful tool in that sense. More on this sort of idea of conceptualizing your data workflow, or what has to happen to this data in order to make it useful to you. You may ask questions like, what data is being collected? How is that data structured? How does it need to be processed? How are you going to store it? You kind of have to understand the world in which this data lives. And there are many different ways that you can go about modeling your data workflow. Here's an example in this sort of flow diagram that was created by one of our group members. Essentially, you'd have an operator of a vehicle, and they press a button to initiate some run. Some sensors would begin to capture data. A GPS receiver would be logged, and data would be saved to a file. Then later, maybe you want to visualize that data on a computer. You move it to a server. You do basic error checking. You need to calculate UTM coordinates of the GPS receivers. You need a plot map of your field experiment to relate to the data. You have to be able to overlay sensor data points on top of this plot map so that you can associate the data with the underlying treatments that were imposed at a given location in the field. And many other things. You can see how complex this can get in terms of the things that have to happen to this data in order to make it useful at the end of the day. And this is an iterative process, so we've gone through several iterations of thinking about how data should be modeled and how we are going to use this in order to move our phenomics program forward. Here's a more recent one. The same principles, where you would design your field experiment and go out and collect data, and you have some geoprocessing that has to happen. You do some quality control and visualization in GIS. Further quality control using outlier removal and FAS and so forth. Okay, so let's, in terms of our data transfer, so currently the data sits on the tractor. How do we get that moved onto our servers? Long story short, I'll just say government security stands in the way here, but we're using this complex method of copying the data to a portable hard drive, which is a RAID 5, and then moving the data via that onto our local networks, and particularly onto a server that I'll discuss in a minute. So this can take time. It takes an hour to do this copy process for a day's worth of field collection, so 2 hours total in terms of transfer to a server. These are the specs of the server that we are currently using. It's a $30,000 Windows machine capable of storing up to about 300 terabytes of data. We're typically adding about 10 terabytes of data per year, but as we move more into imaging and more into LiDAR, we anticipate that we're going to be up in 50, 100 terabytes of data a year. So it's important that you have a server that's capable of handling the level of data that will be collected. This is another part of conceptualizing your data workflow, is how do you store it and back it up. So we have a tractor that captures data, and we move our data onto a server. Eventually, the data will move from files into a database that we're in the process of designing. So it's kind of another backup there. And then our IT department has its own weekly mechanism, or daily mechanisms that back up our machines to a tape. So we have redundant copies of our data. We have a procedure in place in order to ensure that it's backed up properly. In terms of designing databases, I mentioned earlier that it's an important aspect of this work, and we've kind of been lax, in all honesty, in moving this part of the data flow workflow forward. But we're getting there now, where we're needing to design databases. This typically requires a SQL language. The basic syntax for working with databases, allowing you to create databases, modify them, insert data, query databases, update, so forth. A variety of options for selection of your actual database management system. A free one is MySQL, SQL Server, and Oracle is kind of the high-end and more expensive one. I think we're leaning toward this one in the middle, just because we have some people with experience with that one. Databases, the main task is to design the tables, and ideally, just to start simply, my feeling is that the tables that are coming off your data logger should kind of flow naturally into the database tables that you've designed. So we're working on making that link between the folks that design the logger programs that write files on board our Phenomics equipment, and then making those talk efficiently with a database on our server. Okay, I'll skip to a new topic now and talk about field design and layout. So many agronomists and breeders in the room, in order to put a field experiment in the field, you have to also do some conceptualization and planning. These are some things that you have to think about: the number of treatments that you're planning, the dimensions of plots, how you want to organize them and randomize them. If you have border plots or check plots as part of your design, if you have alleyways that aren't sown, we deal with this a lot at our location, and that we have to irrigate our plots. And so the irrigation method has to be factored into how plots are designed. And finally, field implement characteristics that you have on your farm. What implements is your farm working with, and how does that fit into your design? These things all have to be conceptualized, as you're aware, and I've seen breeders and agronomists use different techniques, okay, to conceptualize these plans in their mind, and they're good methods. So I don't hope there's no criticism taken here, but what my main point is that some of the methods that I've seen, like drawing documents in Excel, drawing maps up in Excel sheets, or this example here of using the table function in Word to make draw out a map. I've seen people hand draw maps, and there's, of course, techniques where people go out and plant without planning much at all. It's just based on where the planter trips. If you want to move into the realm of big data analysis for Phenomics, The point is that these sorts of conceptualization methods are ultimately inefficient. So why? And again, I don't mean to criticize, but because they're great for initial conceptualization of your field design. However, plots are usually not drawn to scale on these methods. The plots usually have no geospatial information associated with them. I've seen often, too, that, and this is a little bit of a pet peeve, but the cartographic paradigms are not always used, meaning following the normal way that you would view a map, with north being up and south down and so forth. And ultimately, what these deficiencies lead to is the fact that you are not able to relate sensor data to the underlying treatment plot where that data was collected, and that is a very key part of the data workflow that I'll describe here upcoming. So I proposed geographic information systems, or GIS, as a way to solve these problems. There are a couple of GIS systems that we use. Some of you are familiar with Esri ArcGIS, which is the state-of-the-art, comprehensive, high-dollar GIS system that probably have licenses available on most university campuses. But another one, and this is relatively new, is the Quantum GIS, which is an open source GIS, more lightweight, you can download it for free and so forth. How are these systems used in phenomics? Essentially, they're helpful for preparing your field plot maps in shapefile format. I'll talk about that. They're used to intersect sensor data with your field plot polygons, so you can link the data with a particular location on the Earth. They're very good for data visualization and quality control. And another advantage is that often custom scripts are available that automate some of your workflow tasks in order to move data through a pipeline. So this is a slide that's just showing kind of a plot map that was designed in GIS on top of an orthophoto using manual GIS techniques to draw lines and intersect lines. What we're after at the end of the day is a plot map where your plots are represented in shapefile format using polygons to represent the plot area. So how do you get to that? And there are many different paths to get to this result. So I'm not going to say that any one is better than the other. It's just a matter that you have to get to it somehow, and you have to identify the best way for your particular group. There's two main steps involved. One, you have to get geographic coordinates of your plot corners. And there are a number of ways for that. And two, you have to use those coordinates in order to develop this polygon shapefile. A couple options before planting. You could download an orthophoto of your field site and just lay out your plots in using drawing techniques in GIS. You could also calculate plot corner points if you know some information about your plot size and dimension. There are options after planting. You could go out with a GPS rover and measure the corner points of your plots. It's an option. You could collect a remote sensing image and georeference that remote sensing image to an orthophoto. And then if your image is from after planting, you should actually be able to see your plots visibly, and they'd be georeferenced in that image. And finally, some of our colleagues at KSU have developed algorithms that look into the sensor data itself and try to use the quantity values of the data in order to draw polygons around those data where they should be. So again, the best method is up for debate. Essentially, in our location in Arizona, because we're irrigating, number one, we have to do a lot of pre-planning, and so our methods typically fall up here in designing our layouts in GIS before planting. So once you get these corner coordinates of your plots, it's fairly simple to bring those points into GIS, and there's algorithms available to develop your polygon plot maps from that. Let's talk about geoprocessing for a minute. So two basic steps in terms of how to geoprocess data from ground vehicles. One is you have to combine the data from your GPS receivers along with information about your vehicle heading. I'll talk about why in a minute. And also the static distances that are the offsets from your GPS receiver to each sensor on board the vehicle, to combine that information together in order to what we call georeference the sensor data, or assign geospatial coordinates to each sensor data value. And then finally, the second step is to use the spatial intersection term, our tool in GIS, in order to clip out the data points that fall within your plot boundary map that you created. So here's like the three sets of data that you could consider. You have your plot map polygon, and that would have some information about what cultivars you planted in which plots. It might have information about what management was in that location, be it high water or low water or something else. And you have this spatial coverage, which is essentially the area on the Earth's surface that that particular plot represents. You have your GPS data, which provides you lat-long information for each time that a sensor data value is collected. And so these two can be related there geospatially. And then you have sensors that are collecting various types of data. And those can be related to your GPS through the timestamps of the logger. An important part of the geoprocessing is conversion of lat-long to UTM coordinates. GPS receivers measure data in latitude and longitude. It's the position on a spherical Earth surface using a model of the Earth that we call WGS-84. But it's often not very convenient to work in that unit when you're talking about field plots. We'd like to have it on a two-dimensional planar map. And so in order to make that happen, we do a UTM map projection, UTM standing for Universal Transverse Mercator Map Projection. What it does is it converts the data into a Cartesian coordinate system in meters. So now you're able to discuss distances between data in terms of a unit that makes intuitive sense to you. Coordinate transforms. Okay, so this is always kind of a difficult concept to grasp at first, but I hope the diagram will help. Essentially, this diagram's a vehicle. Okay, pretend it's a tractor. Pretend that the red dot here is the GPS receiver positioned on this tractor. And this would be sort of like, say, a UTM coordinate grid on the Earth's surface somewhere. You can see that the position of the vehicles in both of these cases gives you a coordinate of 4-4, both cases. So in both cases, you'll get the same reading from your GPS receiver. But we also see that the vehicle heading is different. In this case, the vehicle is headed due north with 0 degrees. In this case, it's more of a northwesterly heading with a vehicle heading of 300. And you can see what that does is it essentially positions your sensors, which are the green ovals, in different places. And so one of the most critical parts of the geoprocessing is to calculate the position of each of these sensors uniquely and independently from your GPS receiver position. You do that with the vehicle heading and also the fixed distances between the receiver and each sensor. This is basically pseudocode for the geoprocessing tasks that have to happen. You have to get lat-long from somewhere, GPS receiver. You have to get vehicle heading from somewhere. Usually we measure it, but you can calculate it from GPS data in some cases. In other cases, it will not work. I'll talk about that in a minute. And you need the sensor offset set measured and obtained from the way that you've designed your phenomics vehicle. You have to convert lat-long to UTM coordinates, and there's code available for this online. And finally, you have to use trigonometric functions to do this coordinate transform, which rotates your vehicle around the position of the receiver based on the vehicle heading information. This is the same thing in Python code. Essentially, the two equations that do this coordinate transform are here. It's trigonometric functions involving the heading angle and the offset distances to correct them for vehicle heading. In terms of geoprocessing pitfalls, one thing we learned early on is this difference in terminology of how vehicles move. Okay, so course is typically the term that's used to describe the travel direction of a vehicle. So it's basically the direction in terms of north, south, east, west, or represented as a degrees where the vehicle is traveling. And heading is the direction that the nose the vehicle is pointing. So it could be different. Say, if the vehicle's traveling in reverse, then the course is 180 degrees opposed to the heading. Early on, we used GPS receivers in order to get at the vehicle heading, and the RMC string of GPS will output a column that is basically a course value that's calculated from a history of GPS points. And there are a few pitfalls with that. The data transform that I mentioned to convert data based on the heading of the vehicle actually requires a true heading of the vehicles, the direction that the nose is pointing. So what are the issues? One is with our push cart. Okay, so it just so happens that the way that this cart was designed, it's more practical to push the cart in one direction, and then instead of trying to turn the whole thing around and then push it, you pull it back in the next row. So you're constantly alternating the course of the vehicle while the heading remains fixed. So that's one case where using the RMC string of the GPS receiver would not necessarily work. Another example is shown here in this GIS map. We kept seeing these kind of funky concentric circles in our data, and we're like, what's going on? Essentially, the way that this data was collected is with a tractor with four sensors across a boom. So the horizontal lines can be grouped in sets of four, and that would represent one pass of the vehicle. What's happening here is essentially that the vehicle stopped. Okay, but the vehicle stops. The loggers are still going. Data is still being collected. GPS positions are still being recorded. But those GPS positions have some noise associated with the position. As with any sensor, there's noise associated with it. And so when the GPS receiver calculates vehicle heading or course from a stationary receiver, the heading will bounce around with error. And if you use that then to correct your data, you'll get this kind of a thing where it looks like the boom is spinning around. It's a critical error because it's actually, in that case, positioning data in a plot where it was not collected. So there are a couple solutions to this. I mentioned earlier that now we're using IMUs, or inertial measurement units, to get at vehicle heading. You could use a digital compass, and some of our colleagues go with two GPS receivers on a boom, so you're getting two fixed positions from which you can calculate the heading. This is what we're after at the end of the geoprocessing outcome. This is a quantum GIS window with a plot map loaded, so plot polys would be the rectangles representing our plots. These are cotton plots with two rows of cotton per plot. And then we have some data that's been now successfully overlaid onto our plot. So we're able to then associate these two layers of data together such that we end up with UTM X and Y positions of each sensor individually. We have some data that the sensor is recording here in NDVI, and we have some information about the underlying plot where that data is located. And that would be represented here in a barcode scheme that was designed for this particular plot layout. GIS is also useful for visualization, just making yourself believe that these processing steps have worked and that your data overlays on your field plots in the way that you would expect. So we've developed a GIS workstation. We've got two big monitors here, 32-inch monitors, and our techs can bring up data on these screens and do the processing steps, and then see the end result, and help us all to believe that it's in fact working as we'd expect. Another step in the workflow is quality control number two, we call it, is outlier removal. We have some algorithms in SAS that would go in and look at the data that falls within a plot after it's been processed in this way and pull out data, for example, that might have been collected over a bare soil region of the plot. How much time do I have?
About a minute and a half.
Okay, so I'll touch on this briefly. This is this is what I like to call data enhancement. It's essentially relies on the fact that sensors are inherently limited. Sensors are only measuring a few aspects of the complete crop system. But we have our simulation models that we've developed over decades that try to simulate over time the processes that are happening in the field. And so can we combine our sensor data with our knowledge that's embodied in models and use computational techniques like model inversion to estimate parameters of these models and then use those parameters as additional phenotypes beyond what we're measuring with our sensors? Here's an example of one way that could work. We have a differential equation of plant height. So it basically models how plant height would change over time. In this plot, we see basically 10 measurements. The X's are about 10 measurements of cotton plant height over the course of a growing season. And imagine that you had, say, 500 varieties out there, and so you had 500 different time series of those measurements. So what you could end up doing then is fitting this differential equation to each of your data sets by adjusting the parameters of the model. And the parameters are represented up here. There's one for maximum height, there's one for stem elongation rate, and so forth. And in the process of doing that, you extend your data, you expand it. You have now more than just plant height. You have the estimates that have been given to you by fitting a model to your data. Here's another example of hyperspectral reflectance measurements over cotton that I collected back in our first days with Phenomics. Essentially, I took an ASD FieldSpec Pro hyperspectral radiometer into the field and measured the reflectance of, I think it was 10 or so different varieties. There's also models of this process. So ProSail is essentially a model of how light interacts with plant canopies and is reflected away. There are input parameters to these models, like leaf water content, like pigment characteristics, like chlorophyll A and B, like LAI. These things sound like phenotypes to me. They sound like traits that might be of interest. And so what we could do is a model inversion step where we use an optimizer to combine the data that's collected with our spectral radiometer with what's being output by a model of this process and use it to estimate those parameters that feed into the model, thereby extending our data, expanding it, and making it more useful. So I hope that I've impressed on you that field-based plant phenomics is a lot more than just sensors and vehicles. There's a lot of effort that has to go into your data workflows, your data pipelines. And so I've coined this phrase here that you don't want to end up in this situation, okay, where you have data everywhere and not a bit of help. So I hope that was informative to you. Thank you. We're not doing a very good job at that, I guess, is what I would say. But it would definitely help our procedures, for sure. Sorry, I don't have much to say.
Well, Liz, thanks, Kelly, once more.